652CR, State v. Jacob J. Faust. And representing the District Attorney's Office of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, is District Attorney Mary T. Wagner. She will have 25 minutes to argue the case and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. And Stephen M. Seymour, attorney from Sheboygan, representing Mr. Faust, will have 30 minutes. And I don't see, but on the top of the lectern is a little box, and lights will go on. Green means the council may speak. The orange-yellow light means 5 minutes, warning. Red light means your time is up. So we shall start with Attorney Wagner.
May it please the court. My name is Mary Wagner. I am Assistant District Attorney for Sheboygan County. I represent the state of Wisconsin in this action. Framed in its narrowest terms, this case is about whether the defendant's voluntary breath test following his drunk driving arrest served to trigger the need for a warrant before the police officer could insist upon a blood draw without his consent. The broader issue before the court today is also whether the standards that this court set down in 1993 in State v. Bowling, which govern warrantless blood draws following drunk driving arrests, are still valid, or whether a single statement from the Krajewski case in 2002 will serve to substantially change them. Each of the Bowling standards was met in this case.
Counsel, could you make sure to speak up? I'm having a little difficulty.
I'm sorry.
I wonder if moving the microphone would help. Closer to the speaker, reporter? Yeah, would you?
Any better?
Yes, that is for me. I want to hear your every word. So.
Oh, that's so sweet. Would you like me to start over? Okay.
No, I heard the
not that much.
Okay. Each of the Bowling standards was met in this particular case. The defendant's position is that because he took a breath test, there were no longer exigent circumstances present that would justify a blood draw without a warrant. The state believes that because the blood alcohol level in the defendant's bloodstream was still changing, exigent circumstances were still there. Any delay would both aid in the destruction of evidence and handicap a later decision of whether or how to charge this case. The defendant's interpretation does not square with Bowling and its standards. It doesn't square with the basic law of physics. It unreasonably thwarts a police officer's ability to secure evidence of a serious crime in that narrow window of opportunity before the evidence changes or disappears. And it forces the police to choose between blood and breath test at the outset, regardless of other factors. We ask the court to reverse the trial court's suppression of the blood test results and to allow their use at trial. Now, the defendants are...
Ms. Wagner, yes. Do you think that it would be okay to just keep on with test after test after test, or is there some place where enough is enough?
I believe that Bowling speaks about taking a blood test, and so I would ask the court to consider a blood test to be the bright line rule at which point the exigency would stop. The blood test would essentially freezes the status quo. It can be tested later, it can be argued about later in a way that breath test cannot. And so, of course, every search is always subject to the parameters of reasonableness, but certainly, you know, serial testing can go into the realm of harassment and all sorts of things.
Could the officer here, after the breath test and after the blood test, have said, now I want a urine test?
Under the implied consent statute, I believe he could. Under the Fourth Amendment, there's a big question as to whether that was necessary or reasonable.
So you think the blood test is the test, if you will. After that, there's a real question.
I believe that would be a bright line, yes, there for the blood test.
And why is that? Is the blood test considered more reliable?
It's not considered more reliable, but it's considered retestable, and it is something that can be tested later. There's one opportunity. The breath sample is destroyed in the testing mechanism. It cannot be gone back to. It cannot be retested, whereas blood can be tested again. It can be tested by an independent agency. It can be tested for other substances. Breath also is subject to legal challenges far down the road based on consent, voluntariness, the ability of the defendant to give an accurate breath sample, which may not be apparent to the police on the scene, as well as the maintenance records of the machine, which may at that very moment appear to be giving a perfectly good sample. The police officer administering a breath test has no way of knowing what challenges will be brought later, and there is only that one opportunity, that one narrow window of time in which blood test evidence can be taken. So in some cases, I would imagine, speaking hypothetically, and realizing that this was a particularly close case, there would be some drunk driving arrests where there might be so much other extrinsic evidence, say the person was pulled over after driving the wrong way down the freeway or has been observed weaving all over the road, smells like a bottle of Jack Daniel was used as a shower implement, can't speak clearly, can't do the field sobriety test because he can't stand upright. And the police officer at that point might reasonably think, well, if this person can even give a breath test, that's fine. But even if the test gets tossed later, there's so much other evidence the conviction is certain. In a close case like this, where the defendant was not observed driving badly, where the blood alcohol level was measured at just a hair above the legal limit, the police officer, I believe, was reasonable in his expectation of wanting to secure the other blood test evidence as a backup, just in case the breath test didn't survive challenges which were not apparent at that time, even though the machinery was working.
Telling Justice Crooks, as I understand it, the blood test would always be test, and that's the bright line. The other tests, whether you have breath or urine, would be possibly dependent upon the situation. So you could have breath and blood or urine and blood, but you say it would fall into the reasonableness of each situation if you were to demand more tests, say
after
all three of them.
After that, yes.
But definitely the blood test is the one that you're concerned about and the one that the authority should be using. At least one blood test.
Yes.
And just to carry that further, one blood test would be sufficient.
Under Bowling, I believe it would. Unless, of course, the technician trips on the way down the hall and drops it and another.
They haven't destroyed the same.
Right. Yeah.
Counsel, you seem to base part of your analysis for the blood test, if not all of it, on the idea that it can be retested later. How does that differ from urine? Can't urine test be retested later?
I'm sure they can. Well, actually, medically, I'm not. I don't know anything about urine testing. I would assume that they can. I've never heard of police officers expressing a preference for securing a urine test to a blood sample. I would think of many hindrances, public embarrassment, for one. Some people just can't produce a sample. They have bashful bladders. A blood test is much simpler to procure.
In some instances, yes, I suppose, but in others, by definition, if we're dealing with a group of people that are or potentially are under the influence, I think that suggests that their judgment is impaired. I can envision, although we had no forcible, I can envision a physical lack of cooperation. I think in this case, was it this case that the, or was it the Krasuski case, where they took him to the one place first and they wouldn't do it unless there was an agreement to give blood consensually?
I believe that was the Krasuski
case, okay. But I can envision, because by their nature there's an impairment of judgment, people saying, no, you can't take my blood, and physical restraint being needed. I don't think that's out of the question at all. My experience of drunk drivers and their lack of judgment.
That's very true.
So we have a... now, this is exaggeration for... Well, I won't exaggerate for emphasis, but I can see unfolding this kind of situation with some frequency, the physical restraint being needed in order to exact the blood.
It's entirely possible. It happens, yes.
May I ask, if we're under the statute, the officer, as I read the statute, is entitled to take more than one test.
Yes.
And a breath test was requested, and a breath test was given. And then a blood test was requested, and that was denied. Did the officer take the driver's license, and did the Sheboygan County District Attorney's Office moved to revoke the person's license for failure to supply the blood test.
Steve, did they? I don't remember.
To be honest, I entered the case actually fairly late in the case, and the issue of testing and revocation really never came up. I certainly think my interpretation with the law would be that they could have pursued that angle. Whether they did in this case, I'm not entirely sure.
It would be standard practice, too.
Well, now, let me be extremely unfair to you. You are an assistant district attorney representing the state of Wisconsin, and you're before the Supreme Court, and all our sessions are recorded and can be heard on the Internet. Are you telling us today, representative of the state of Wisconsin, that the breath test is not reliable?
No. I'm not saying that this is a question of reliability. It is a question of securing the evidence when it can be had. As the court in, as a matter of fact, paragraph 55 of the Krajewski case noted, there are, in talking about what's usable and satisfactory, what is usable for one purpose or satisfactory for one purpose may not be for another. For example, one test may be more efficacious before a jury. One test may be more convenient for an officer based on the circumstances of a particular case. And that is what I'm saying. The police officer that I spoke with, Officer Olson, who performed this arrest, has never spoken in terms of wanting a blood test because he wanted a more reliable test. He wanted to secure the evidence while it was there to be gotten. Because it was a close case, he knew it would be hard fought. As a third offense, the penalties are going up. The interest of the state continues to escalate in terms of deterring a repeat offender, and that the window of opportunity was closing. So to forestall any further challenges in case they would arise on a breath test, he decided to go for blood. But no, I'm not saying that a breath test is less accurate than blood.
Well, this may or may not be this case. Blood would allow for the substance taken, and I imagine drugs and or breath would not find that.
This is true.
Is there a tendency to extract blood because of that? Just not in this case. Detect other sulfur. It would be.
It is always a possibility. It is my understanding that as a general routine practice, if a blood sample is sent off to the state hygiene lab and comes back above the legal limit, no further drug tests are ordered because at this point the defendant has already been proven to have a prohibited alcohol concentration and that's sufficient to convict under the statute.
Counselor, does it make any difference to your Fourth Amendment argument that this blood draw occurred after arrest as compared with before an arrest?
I don't think so. Bowling, clearly, the standards in bowling are a per se rule. I believe they do comport with the Fourth Amendment. They are fairly strict. The standard in that case, which has been the framework for litigating drunk driving, warrantless blood draw.
The bowling, one of the standards of bowling, the second one is, the person has been lawfully arrested.
Yes.
Okay, so are you telling me that that's not a dispositive factor of bowling, that if the person hadn't been arrested, you could still do the same test?
I think if the person hadn't been arrested, say, for example, they were unconscious at the scene of an accident and taken to a hospital,
right.
There would still be a reasonableness inquiry under the Fourth Amendment that would not fall under the parameters of bowling because those are strictly right. For persons who are placed under arrest.
Okay, but absent someone being unconscious and not being able to say yes or no to your request, does it matter? My next question is why, so you know where I'm going.
I'm trying to frame the question in a way I can understand it. Does it matter whether the person has been arrested first in terms of Fourth Amendment?
Exactly.
If there are exigent circumstances present and the person has, in Wisconsin it seems to, because of the bowling parameters, under the Fourth Amendment, taking us out of the per se rule of bowling, I believe that would be a case-by-case inquiry as to whether there were sufficient indicators that a person, there was reasonable cause to arrest. or probable cause to arrest. The police can't just pull over anybody for any reason and test them for drunk driving. Under the Fourth Amendment, that would not be fair, that would not be reasonable. There have to be indicators that the driver is impaired before an intrusion like this would be allowable. I believe that's why, under not only Bowling but Schmerber back in 1966, when the U.S. Supreme Court first discussed the exigent circumstances exception, that there has to be a clear indication that this blood test evidence will produce an indication or proof of intoxication. That clear evidence seems to be a slightly higher standard.
Well, exigent circumstances, that means, if I understand this, is that, look, we have blood, we have strike that, we have alcohol that's dissipating, and we want to be able to act while it is still in the bloodstream, correct?
As yes. Far,
and that continues throughout, and that's the reason for perhaps having the blood test or comparing it to whether or not there is exigent circumstances. That's what I understand is the dissipation of the alcohol.
Yes, and the dissipation of the alcohol has been considered an exigent circumstance since, I think, beyond even Schmerber in 1966, going back to Breithaupt v. Abrams, decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1957. And this has always been premised on the fact that alcohol dissipates from the system. And not only that, a very important point to make here is that the blood alcohol level of a drunk driving suspect is always in a state of flux. It may be rising depending on whether alcohol is still being absorbed in the system, depending on when the driving has been done. It may be also, at the time it's absorbing, the metabolism is also dissipating some of it. So the one thing, the one immutable natural law that is clear in every single drunk driving case is that blood alcohol level never stays the same. It is always not only on a course to be destroyed, it can also be on a course to be rising. It has been noted even in a Law Review article which was cited by the dissent in Bowling, in vino, and I don't know how to pronounce Latin, so I'm going to take a guess, veritas or veritas. The author in that case makes a statement that it is entirely possible for the blood alcohol level of a drunk driving suspect to rise from a non-criminal level when they are arrested to one that is criminally prohibited by the time the test is taken. And so even in that article, which was a broader point that the person was making over many pages, but even that seems to feed the idea that delay serves no one. It serves not the state. It serves not the defendant in terms of proving what that blood alcohol level actually was at the time of driving. And it is always, that exigency is always present until the status quo can be frozen by a blood draw.
Counsel, you're here because you lost the case, obviously.
Yes.
Of course, the issue. All right. But the state's usually here for broader issues than a particular case because there are recurring cases of driving while intoxicated, right? And as I read the Court of Appeals decision, it relies on the following language. The exigency that exists because of dissipating alcohol does not disappear until a satisfactory usable chemical test has been taken. Now, is a breathalyzer a chemical test?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So the Court of Appeals said you got a breathalyzer. You come within that exception, so there's no exigency. Therefore, it would be violative of the Fourth Amendment to take blood without a search warrant. Right?
Yes, that's the sentence we've been arguing about in Sheboygan for about the past year.
Pardon me?
That is the sentence we've been arguing about in Sheboygan
right.
for the past year.
And that's the sentence, and the court relies on that. And then there's a concurrence by Judge Nettesheim that says, look, I join because we, the Court of Appeals, are bound by what this court says. But he says, I don't like it. I think that's not a good sentence, and it's inconsistent with other parts of our opinion. And in effect, he says this court should do something about it, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's a fast summary of many pages, right?
Yes.
Okay. So my question to you in light of that setup is, what does the state want us to do? Now, we've got the consent law that says you consent to any and all tests, in effect. I mean, that's the state's position, right?
Yes.
And you can be revoked if you fail to consent to any test. If you've taken two already but fail to consent to the third, you're revoked, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what rule of law does the state want this court to adopt in drunk driving cases? Isn't that what we're here about?
Yes. And it would be a two-part request. One would be to reaffirm the standards in Bowling.
Well, that you have to do more than that.
Okay. And the second one would be to either withdraw that sentence from Kajewski regarding the usable satisfactory chemical test sample, or to interpret it as to establish that blood would be the bright line rule where the exigency finally stops.
So once you do the blood test, that's it?
Yes.
No,
that would
more
freeze
tests.
The status, that would freeze the status quo for the purposes of the state.
Whether the blood is first or the blood is third as a test. Blood freezes it.
Blood freezes it. I can't think of why, under the implied consent law, that a police officer would then want to order breath, but it could be that the defendant wants a breath test. That would be acceptable. But blood would freeze the status quo.
Or this is a belt and suspender police officer who doesn't know what the court's going to do next, so he's going to play it. She's going to play it very safe. Right? Possibly.
I'm sorry.
Think that's too safe, asking for all three?
I think it's probably too time intensive for what a police officer does and needs to get back on the road.
I agree that it sounds too time intensive, which may be why you do the breathalyzer and not transport the person to a hospital, too.
That's true. And also, something that just came to my attention recently in speaking with Officer Olson, that despite all of the other legal challenges that breath tests are subject to much later on, there is a virtue in speed and efficiency for the officer in that once the breath test is taken, the results are instant, and so all the paperwork gets done at once. The operating while intoxicated ticket is written, the prohibited alcohol concentration ticket is written, and the six-month administrative suspension notice is all written at the same time, as opposed to waiting a few weeks for the blood test to come back, finding that the defendant indeed had a prohibited alcohol concentration, and then filling out further paperwork. So, just recently, something to throw into the pot as to why police sometimes do breath. Also, you know, they take breath samples rather than blood tests first because some departments require them to do that. It can be a department policy. Some departments prefer blood to be their primary test, but perhaps still do breath tests for first offenses where the burden of proof is lower for the state as well as the amount of sanction to the defendant. So, breath tests have their place, and it's not a question of accuracy here. It's a question of preserving the evidence in light of possible future legal challenges.
I don't know if it is a matter of preserving the evidence, because unscientifically, we just discussed that maybe urine achieves that same goal of preservation. In recounting the comments of the officer that you talked with, I can envision the officers that would appear before me when I was a circuit court judge haranguing about the Supreme Court if we adopted a blood test as a bright line first choice rule, given the administrative, if you will, difficulties. In other words, they have to wait for it till the blood test results get back. Sometimes the state crime lab is backed up. Then you get that, and then you've got to get to your desk work and fill out all the necessary forms, and then where is the person that you picked up on the highway a month and a half ago? Ooh, that could cause a lot of administrative difficulties, what you're asking for.
I'm sorry, actually, if I was unclear, I didn't mean to say that blood tests should be first choice in every case, or that the state should abandon breath testing, or law enforcement should abandon breath testing, but that the bright line for when the exigency ends be considered blood, so that if a breath test is taken, and in this case, as it turned out, that the blood test result was very, very close to the threshold for legal driving, that blood then be the last line.
Yes, and indeed you did say that. I guess I just extrapolated what you said to really suggest that you were inferring that, listen, you want no hassles, you want no problems, just take a blood test all the time. That way you don't have to deal with, you know, dissipating any problems. But you're not advancing that.
No, no. I can think of a number of police officers who would probably,
that
would rather have the option.
Back in Sheboygan County,
yes, it, the option, I believe, should be there at the discretion of the police officer who is the person on the front line, who is the person dealing with the arrest and with his or her experience in the challenges that are brought. I'm sure Officer Olson was a little surprised when a breath test came back at a 0.09, given that the preliminary breath test by the side of the road was measured at a 0.13. I think he was a little surprised at the fact that the blood alcohol level was that close of a case, or that marginally above. And at that point, he recognized this is going to be a close case. I should secure the evidence while I can.
Do we have to say what the outer limits of exigent circumstances in this context are in order to decide this case?
We don't have to, as I see it, have to draw a bright line rule about where the exigency ends in order to decide this case.
Well, that would depend on whether you're going to leave that sentence about the satisfactory and usable test sample in or not. I think if that language is going to be amplified, then a bright line rule might have to be drawn. And if the language was withdrawn, that could still be an open issue.
Is that what the state's suggesting, we withdraw that sentence? Are there any other sentences that have to be modified, changed, withdrawn, explained? Judge Nettesheim's opinion seems to indicate there are.
That was the only one that was giving us a big headache in Sheboygan. That was the only sentence that I could identify as the crux of this case, that this case boiled down to how that language is going to be applied.
And on a positive holding, the holding I assume that you want is that regardless of whether the police officer has performed a breathalyzer test or a urine test, the police officer may have a blood test performed, because alcohol is dissipating, therefore you've got the exigent circumstances. Is
yes.
that what you want?
Yes, essentially that to reaffirm the standards in Bowling.
Bowling says blood is drawn to take blood is taken to obtain evidence of intoxication from a person lawfully arrested.
Yes.
For drunk driving. Is a clear indication the blood draw will produce evidence of intoxication. The method used to take the blood sample is a reasonable one and performed in a reasonable manner. And the arrestee presents no reasonable objection to the blood draw.
Yes, Your Honor.
Those are the four.
Those are the four. I believe those comport with the Fourth Amendment and are still
this
valid.
Case then presents a constitutional issue that the court faces. Right?
I think so.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Seymour, representing the defendant, Jacob J. Faust.
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Seymour, and I represent the defendant respondent, Jacob Faust, in this case. In considering the issue at hand, it's conceded that the state has a legitimate interest in protecting the safety of its citizens through the enforcement of our drunk driving laws. The question becomes, what level of authority or what tools can be granted to law enforcement to assist in the enforcement of these laws before the protections afforded by the Fourth Amendment are unreasonably infringed upon? I would respectfully submit that the language contained in this court's decision in Krajewski with respect to when exigent circumstances justifying a warrantless blood draw would and would not exist, as relied upon by the trial and appellate courts in the instant case, strikes a proper balance between promoting the state's interest in enforcing the drunk driving laws and protecting the constitutional rights of the defendant. On the other hand, I would respectfully suggest that the standard which the state is asking the court to adopt in this case crosses the line as to what would be appropriate and would result in a policy inconsistent with fundamental and longstanding principles controlling the authority of law enforcement to conduct searches in the absence of a warrant. In Schmerber, the U.S. Supreme Court discussed that search warrants are required to search dwellings, and absent an emergency, no less can be required where intrusions into the human body are concerned. The state contends that exigent circumstances or an emergency exist in all drunk driving cases because of the need to collect evidence before alcohol dissipates in the system. However, as Krajewski points out, once law enforcement has obtained a valid chemical sample establishing that the driver's blood alcohol level is over the legal limit, the exigent circumstances no longer exist.
Counsel, there was a valid breath test taken in this case.
Correct. There was not only the PBT or portable breath test taken at the scene. My client was later transported to the police station and he took an intoxilizer test, which was requested of him and which he consented to, and the reading came back at a .09, which was over the legal limit because this would have been a third offense for him.
Okay. But it was over the legal limit for your client.
Correct.
Why did you take the time then to move to suppress the blood test if there's such a valid, good breath test?
Well, I anticipate that if the blood test result is suppressed and the state has only the breath test in this case with which to prosecute Mr. Founce, we do have a defense to the breath test result based upon my client's history of acid reflux, which would question whether or not that was a very reliable sample. In other words, if my client was regurgitating or belching during the 20-minute observation period, the scientific argument is that really the 20-minute test or the 20-minute waiting period needs to be stopped and restarted again in order for the sample to be reliable.
Now, there, I watch television and I see ads for acid reflux disease all the time. Does that mean because people have this problem that the state is justifying taking a blood test?
Again, I think that comes down perhaps to a question of reliability. If the state is concerned that breath is not as reliable a test because of either potential defenses like the one I've mentioned or because perhaps the community at large has less faith in an intoxilizer, which is a machine, as opposed to the testing of blood, which I think, in my mind at least, the community as a whole probably would find to be more reliable. Yes, that might be a reason why law enforcement may decide to choose the blood test as their primary or first test as opposed to a breath test. But in this case,
so
it
you,
was clear.
You want them to choose that as their first test and not the second test?
I don't want them to choose either or, to be honest. They have that choice. The law grants them that choice under the implied consent law. It's up to the officer to decide which test they want to employ. And Krajewski discusses that's, you know, what we want our law enforcement officers to have, is that discretion. You know, Krajewski actually dealt with a case where the officer requested the blood test as a first test, and the defendant said, no, I don't really want to take a blood test, but I will take a breath test. And the officer said, no, I want the blood test, and they went down and took the sample without a warrant, and the case went from there. And one of the concerns in Krajewski in finding that we're not going to allow drivers to be the ones making the choices, it takes control of the investigation out of the hands of officers. And that's not what I'm asking the court to do here. The officer has the right to choose which test they want to ask for, not only in the first case, but in the second or the third case. What the issue here really comes down to is, again, if they have a first test taken, they have a valid sample, I think the implied consent law allows them to ask for a second test, but the issue becomes, what happens if the driver refuses to take that test?
Isn't he just guilty of violating the statute, and then you have a revocation for refusal under the statute, and with his priors, he would have been revoked for 2 years, right?
That's true.
Okay, but that's, you know, we also have a case, I think it's Wintolin, by the Court of Appeals that says, or maybe it's Gibson, one or the other, that says that the refusal is not the state's exclusive remedy, which kind of puts me back to my question to opposing counsel. On a constitutional basis, forget the statute. Say we don't have this statute. Facts are the same. Is it necessary that Faust be under arrest at the time the blood draw was completed to the constitutional analysis?
I guess I would have to agree that I don't know that it does. I still think you're looking at, again, a reasonableness approach, and you're also, again, looking at this exigent circumstances issue that controls all searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, if you're just walking down the street, and I'm a police officer, and I don't like your suit that you have on today, can I stop you, haul you in, and say, I'm going to take a blood test?
No, obviously
okay.
not.
If you're driving your car, and you're driving a Mercedes, and I wish I had one, but I don't happen to have one, can I stop you because your license plate is on crooked and haul you in and get a blood test?
You may be able to pull the person over if the license was somehow a violation, but no, I think before you'd be allowed to take a blood test or any other test, there would have to be probable cause to believe that the person was driving under the influence.
Well, or had committed some crime.
Exactly.
Okay, so if you got probable cause to arrest, you think that's enough? You don't actually have to place somebody under arrest?
Correct, because I think actually, I think it's the probable cause to arrest which, again, triggers the ability to request the tests in question, whether you're talking about blood or breath or anything else. I don't know that an arrest is necessarily actually made until there is, you know, some, you know, evidence there that actually shows that they're intoxicated. So,
Well, this guy was under the arrest. He'd been issued a ticket for OMVWI before these tests were done. That's what the record says.
Correct.
Okay. All right. It's just something that bothers me, obviously.
Sure.
Thank you.
If a forcible blood draw is appropriate for Fourth Amendment purposes as a first test, if it's considered reasonable under those circumstances for Fourth Amendment purposes, why isn't it reasonable as a second test?
Again, because I believe that the underlying premise behind, the right for law enforcement to take samples of whether it's breath or blood or anything else, again, is that there is exigent circumstances which exist, that there's an emergency, a need to collect this evidence. And again, that need supersedes the requirement to get a warrant. We have to collect this evidence now. We can't wait for the warrant, so that's what we're going to do. If it's a second test, again, I believe that exigency doesn't exist anymore. There isn't an emergency any longer because the first test has already been taken. There's already been evidence collected. That's not only a valid sample, but in the case at hand, which established that this individual was driving over the legal limit.
But the validity of that first sample won't be determined for perhaps many months. So the exigency in terms of the destructibility of the evidence has not
And again, I think at that point we're looking more, again, at the reliability issue. Again, if officers have some reason to believe that the breath test is going to be more subject to challenge, and they want to have stronger evidence, there's nothing stopping them from using the blood test as a first test. In the case at hand, though, there was no reason to believe at the time that the breath test was taken and the .09 result was reached that this was going to be an issue. The officer did not say, hey, I decided to take this blood test because I'm afraid this person is going to be able to claim acid reflux and therefore I want more evidence.
Well, that begs the question, though. And I go back to my original
question, the admissibility, the reliability of that breath test, which the officer resorted to as a first test under the statute, is not going to be determined for many months. So the exigency is still present in terms of the destructibility of the evidence and the need to collect it because the alcohol is dissipating over time. That exigency, and that's the exigency that Schmerber and Bowling and Krajewski focused on, that exigency is still present.
But I guess the way I would look at it is the what Justice Wilcox perhaps raised kind of indirectly is, at what point do we stop? I mean, the test results are not going to perhaps be challenged for months and months after they are taken. So that means that the officers can continue to do testing and testing until they've got such a mountain of evidence where that's ultimately not going to be a concern.
We don't have that slippery slope case here now. We have this one. And so we don't have to decide what the outer limits of that exigency are in order to decide this case. Here we have a blood draw, forcible blood draw that was done after a breath test. And if that forcible blood draw was reasonable for Fourth Amendment purposes, if it had been administered before the breath test, why is it not still reasonable after?
And again, I guess my point is, like I had said before, that after they've already received a different test sample,
that may or may not be usable. Right?
Correct. That's true. But again, I still think that the exigent circumstances that justify doing warrantless searches still ends once they have obtained that evidence. There's not an emergency any longer.
Here, the state's argument, if I understand it, is that, look, we're in the evidence collecting business at that time, and here you had supposedly a valid arrest, and we can collect the evidence, and they're asking the court or saying that, look, we think that they'd like it to say at least one blood test could be taken. And that doesn't seem to violate, I think that's what Judge Sykes is saying, it doesn't seem to violate. It's like, in the collection you have one fingerprint, well, that's enough, we don't want to take the other three to find out what they may mean. And so the argument would be you would be stopping or preventing the state from collecting the evidence at the time it's collectible, because it wouldn't be collectible, tomorrow, the next day, because the dissipation would have occurred.
Again, I guess, like I said, I think that there are still limits to what law enforcement is allowed to do in the collection of evidence, which is, again, based upon the exigency. Again, in terms of gathering evidence, you don't have search warrant issues in all cases where they're trying to collect evidence.
But the limitation, they being your opposing counsel, indicated is we want one blood test. So whether you have a urine test or a breath test, we would like one blood test. Not a question I think others asked, and perhaps myself, is, well, is there... The stopping point seems to be after you've taken the blood, at least for this type of situation, then that's it. There isn't a second or third or fourth blood test or something of that nature.
And again, I guess that issue can be easily enough addressed by, again, allowing the officers to choose the blood test as their first test if that's what they would like to do. And then you don't get into the situation of multiple tests, again, collecting evidence without a warrant where there really are not exigent circumstances any longer. It seems to me that the reason why they're doing the breath test as opposed to the blood test is a matter of expediency. They're probably cheaper, they're quicker.
It also gets the drunk driver off the road faster, right? And that's one of the policies that, in fact, that's the whole driving policy behind the drunk driving laws.
And again, I guess then that law enforcement has to weigh those legitimate concerns, though, against these questions about reliability. I think that's really what it boils down to, is the officer and the state is basically saying, we've got concerns about these breath tests, so even though we've got a valid sample that's over the legal limit, we want to go one step further and we want blood to be able to secure that. And they have the right to ask for it under the implied consent law. And the defendant has the right to refuse it if they don't want to give their consent and face penalties if they do that. And the question becomes, do we go that next step and allow the warrantless blood draw to collect the evidence under those circumstances? And again, I would respectfully submit that under the Fourth Amendment, that would not be proper.
What? Mr. Seymour, do you think that the statute here is unconstitutional, that it violates the Fourth Amendment? I'm looking at 343.305, and it talks about one or more tests. It talks about one or more samples. As I listen to your argument, you must be making an argument that that statute violates the Fourth Amendment unless there's a warrant for the second or subsequent test.
No, I don't. I'm not arguing the constitutionality of that statute at all. What I'm saying is the statute allows the offer to make the request for one or more tests. And again, there's nothing from stopping the officer from doing so. Again, the issue becomes what happens if the driver refuses to give their consent. Obviously, under the implied consent law, the driver faces the penalties. The automatic revocation of license, regardless of what happens in the underlying OWI case, as well as the potential that the refusal itself is going to be used as evidence against the defendant if they take their OWI case to trial.
Do you think the statute is set up the way it is just to basically put a person in a trap where he or she will end up with a refusal and a revocation because they say no to the second or third test?
No, I don't believe so. Again, you know, drivers in obtaining their licenses and driving on the roads in the state of Wisconsin have to be of, you know, of the understanding that they are under an obligation to submit to those tests if, you know, legally required to do so, and that there are going to be penalties if they choose not to abide by that. Again, if they refuse and the officer goes ahead and takes a warrantless blood draw and collects a sample, and we have a case like we do here, again, that the driver does have the ability to raise the same type of defense that I've raised in Mr. Faust's case to try to challenge those test results.
Yeah. Results of the second test.
Correct.
That's my understanding that you don't object to any of the four criteria in bowling, but what you do object to is a blanket, flat-out determination, a per se determination, that if you're arrested for drunk driving, that automatically means it's an exigent circumstance.
Exactly.
That's your position.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Now, he's driving. He stopped for drunk driving. And they have a nurse in the car with a portable blood test unit. They can give him the test. Exigent circumstances, blood, the alcohol dissipates. It's given consent to any test. You object to that?
Well, assuming that way of taking the test would be considered reasonable under the third step,
okay,
yes.
If not, they're right outside the hospital.
Right, sure,
so
yes.
We're going to fit all the four. You don't object to that?
No.
Because it's exigent circumstances. You think that the exigent circumstances dissipate or disappear when there's been one good chemical test?
Yes.
So you like and agree with the sentence that's been bandied about in the concurrence and the majority opinion?
Absolutely.
I think that's the right law.
I do think it's the right law.
Well, why, if it's exigent circumstances at minute one at the stop, why do those exigent circumstances disappear at minute five? This is after they've taken the breathalyzer or urine test. What has changed that the exigent circumstances are no longer present?
Again, I think it goes back to the fact that once a valid, usable chemical sample has been taken, and produces evidence of intoxication that the state can use to prosecute this individual for drunk driving, again, we're not looking at that emergency, which is the premise behind allowing the warrantless blood draw in the first place. And I understand the state's interest in collecting evidence before it dissipates so that they can prosecute these crimes. And there, you know, and the fact that that exigency itself is going to exist in all drunk driving cases, assuming, again, that Bowling's being followed. But again, once they've been allowed to collect that evidence, once they have that valid sample, once they have something there that they can prosecute, again, I don't think there's that emergency that exists any longer.
Okay, so would you say they can get blood, they got to get a search warrant? Right now it's midnight, the courts aren't open, they got a judge on duty in Racine County or Sheboygan County. You want the police officers to make the telephone call if they allow that, make the report, ask for a search warrant, right?
Again, this is assuming there's already been a first test. I think that's what I think the Fourth Amendment would require is to obtain the warrant under those circumstances.
It's going to take at least a half hour, I mean minimum half hour.
No, I understand.
It'll be 2 hours.
Right, no, I understand those arguments. I do, but again, this if we're talking about this is the first test, then obviously going through that timing and destroying any possibility of obtaining evidence with which to prosecute is one thing. But again, once you've got that evidence, again, I don't think that emergency exists which allows you to go without the warrant to take the blood.
Well, let's say I agree with you.
Okay.
That there's not, the emergency is less significant once there's a valid test. So what? Blood test is not a big deal. Drawing blood becomes simpler and simpler each year. Kids can draw blood with a prick of a finger. I mean, I don't know how much blood is needed for these kinds of tests, so maybe you have to go into do a more intrusive invasion of the body. But, you know, we've got a lot of drunk drivers out on the road, a lot of killing and maiming. And why are we getting so uptight, counsel, about drawing a bit of blood from somebody who's driving a 3,600-pound weapon, drunk?
Well, first of all, I would agree that the level of intrusion itself is probably not very high on the scale. I mean, there's a lot of more intrusive things.
Stomach pump.
Exactly. There's no question about that, particularly, as you said, as time goes on. But it's an intrusion nonetheless. It's an intrusion into somebody's body. It's more intrusive than a breath test is, where you're talking about somebody blowing into a machine. There still is some level of intrusion that is involved. And again, I believe that under the Fourth Amendment, that intrusion should only be permitted where this emergency exists, where these exigent circumstances exist. And like I said, I don't believe that that emergency exists any longer when we're talking about the second test as opposed to the first test.
Is there any other states do? If they're comparable, because this may be a peculiar law to Wisconsin.
To be honest, I am not overly aware of how this particular issue has come down in other states. I think obviously all states have these similar concerns or interests in protecting their citizens from the drunk driving laws, but in terms of whether implied consent exists in other cases and how that would mesh with the issue of the exigent circumstances, I'm not sure.
Is there any other context in the Fourth Amendment context where the presence of exigent circumstances for purposes of dispensing with the warrant requirement is evaluated on the basis of the existence of other evidence? That's what I understand your argument to be.
Sure.
You've already got some other evidence, so there's no more exigent circumstances for purposes of dispensing with the warrant requirement.
Not that I'm aware of. Most of the other cases that I saw, again, dealt more with the exigent circumstances in connection with what is the interest that the government is trying to protect in the case at hand. For instance, that Skinner case that the states cited in their brief, you know, talks about, you know, where we've got issues about controlling probationers or protecting governmental offices or schools or those types of things. There's going to be such an important state interest there that we feel that there's going to be, you know, the exigent circumstances to be doing this under, you know, most circumstances. I'm not aware of another situation that is comparable to this where we're looking at it as a matter of collection of other evidence versus what's being attempted to obtain without the warrant.
We don't typically evaluate exigent circumstances based upon a sort of subjective look at what other evidence might be available.
Well, not specifically, no, but I think, again, I think it falls under the general rule of the reasonableness is, again, is something reasonable or not? And I think, again, that the law down through the ages with respect to the issue of warrants has been that it's not going to be considered reasonable if there is no exigent circumstances or no emergency. And again, we get back to that issue then.
Suppose you were trying to think of an example that would fit Justice Sykes' concern. Suppose you had probable cause to believe that drugs were being sold from a house, and you thought that you had reasonable belief that they were also going to be destroyed or moved instantly. Could you go into the house without a warrant?
Again, there are some no-knock
That's
laws.
With a warrant. Warrant and no-knock go together, I think. Let's take no-knock out of it.
Okay.
Can you enter a house? Or take a car, which is easier to enter. What I'm driving at is getting into an exigent circumstance where you are going to enter without a warrant, but then a couple of days later, and you do get your evidence, but a couple of days later you figure there's something else too relating to the same charge. Maybe the house is empty by then, so no one's going to destroy any remaining drugs. You didn't look into the right closet. Do you need a warrant?
I think you would.
Even though you might have made the first entry without.
Possibly. I mean, there are, you know, searches, whether of vehicles or of dwellings, which are permissible as incidents to arrest that are made. But I think, again, to go back for a second kick at the cat, so to speak, I think you would probably need a warrant in those circumstances.
I guess a better example than drugs might be somebody in danger in that house, screaming, police enter, find things while they're there in plain view, but then figure there's something else on the basis of what the witness says.
I think the law would require them to get a warrant. Right. What they found and what they learned would serve as the probable cause to obtain the warrant. But yes, I think they'd have to obtain a warrant before they could go back to the scene and start collecting evidence again.
Well, just from a policy standpoint, the Fourth Amendment is sometimes applied less strictly when a person is in an automobile than when they are in their home, for example. And I think the Chief Justice at least alluded to the fact that we are all aware of what happens on the highway when people drink and the death and destruction and things that it causes. From that standpoint, many of the cases that I look talk about that, talk about the very same thing, the policy of driving, the fact that you drive, it's a privilege. Different than when you're, say, in your own home, and we have applied that to perhaps drug seizures and other things. Does that undermine your argument at all as far as what is expected here from a driver of a motor vehicle? In other words, some states, some countries have, you can't drink and drive at all.
Sure.
You can't drive, and if you're caught, that's it. You just lose your... for a lifetime.
Sure.
I think in Norway, I'm not sure, one of the Scandinavian countries. But considering that, is that a consideration for this court?
I think there's two issues there. The first issue about whether the fact that a person's in a vehicle is different than when they're in a home, I really don't think would apply to this case or would undermine what my arguments would be, because I think what you're talking about there is more the person's privacy expectations of the vehicle itself versus their home, and that's really, I don't think, what we'd be talking about here. With respect to the legitimate interest in protecting people from drunk drivers, again, that's without dispute. But there's obviously limits to that. There's also all kinds of other offenses that we want to protect our citizens from, drug offenses, violent crimes. You know, you go through a laundry list of a million things that we want to protect our citizens from, but we don't, in those other instances, necessarily extend the exceptions to the search warrant rule beyond what would be reasonable just because we want to try to fight those crimes, and I think that's in large part what we're talking about here.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Wagner, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I apologize in advance for a rather scattershot approach because there are quite a few points that I'd like to address here. The first would be the privacy expectation of drivers, and Justice Abrahamson, you had brought this up. Why would we get upset at the thought of a non-intrusive, relatively slower?
Yeah,
okay, I'm sorry.
Just a bit
all right.
Difficulty hearing, and if you speak more slowly.
Okay.
And I speak closer to the microphone, we'll be fine.
Okay, that's better?
All right. Yes.
Regarding the privacy interest expected by a driver in Wisconsin, Justice Abrahamson, you had brought up the point of balancing a relatively non-intrusive blood test versus the fact that somebody is driving a 3,500-pound weapon. And this is very true. A driver, and it's very relevant, I think, to this particular case, as well as other drunk driving cases, a driver in Wisconsin, and in fact in most other cases, is subject to a pervasive web of regulation. When it comes to driving a car, before you can drive, you have to be schooled, you have to be tested, you have to pass your test, you have to be licensed, your car has to have its equipment in working order, you need proof of insurance, and you need your car to be registered. Then, once you take it out of the garage, you have to conform your behavior to everything that you see along the side of the road, the traffic signs, the stop signs, the lane changes, the red light, green light, all that sort of stuff. And you also have to conform your behavior to everything that is not posted by the side of the road, which means that every time you fail to dim your brights, every time you speed in excess, every time you fail to yield, if you hang a pair of fuzzy dice that are too big from your rearview mirror, you invite police intervention. You know somebody's going to be pulling you over and saying, I'd like to see your license and registration. So that is a given every time you sit down behind the wheel and take your car out. Add to that a few drinks, which are guaranteed to impede both your judgment and your motor skills. In this case, the 5 brandies taken by Mr. Faust, and I believe that the person sitting by the side of the road in a pair of handcuffs, having been placed under arrest for drunk driving, has a very, very minimal expectation of privacy at that point, and no reason to think that a blood test is not going to be taken to collect evidence of this crime.
When you say minimal, do you mean as in no expectation of privacy?
In terms of a blood test, no expectation.
You seem to be arguing here for a, as I hear it, a blanket rule that under the Fourth Amendment, there is a blanket rule that a blood test will always be a reasonable search because of the potential for dissipation of the blood alcohol content and therefore the evidence. Are you arguing for a blanket rule?
We have a blanket rule. That was the per se rule in bowling, and I recognize your dissension. Krajewski called into question that whether bowling, in fact, survives U.S. or Richards v. Wisconsin, which was, of course, rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court.
So what do you think?
I have a really great argument if you're going to give me the time to make it.
Well, you have about a minute and a half, I suppose.
All right.
You didn't cite Richards in your case.
No, but...
Nor did opposing counsel.
Yeah. No, this is true. I just looked it up because I was researching the dissent in Krajewski, which is the case that we were arguing. May I make the argument?
Certainly.
Okay.
Until your red light goes on.
All right. I believe that bowling survives Richard for 3 reasons. The U.S. Supreme Court has not entirely banned per se rules under the Fourth Amendment. If it did, we wouldn't have the searches incident to arrest under U.S. v. Robinson. We wouldn't have the automotive searches of New York v. Belton or California v. Acevedo. We wouldn't have the limited protective sweeps of Maryland v. Bowie. And we wouldn't have, of course, the Skinner case, which this court, in fact, relied upon heavily in its bowling decision. Furthermore, the drunk driving arrests and the blood tests are very different from the situation that the court envisioned in Richards, which was the police intrusion to a person's house, or in Mr. Richards' case, his motel room, to search to execute a felony drug warrant. As the Supreme Court noted earlier this year in Illinois v. Litster, the Fourth Amendment does not treat a motorist's home as its castle for all the reasons that I've just stated.
What happened to Welch, the case in the Wisconsin Supreme Court that went to the United States Supreme Court when they were following a drunk driver, ran into his house, and without a warrant, the police later went into his house, and the United States Supreme Court said, no, you couldn't do that.
Well, for one thing, it couldn't go into his house. Again, you have those higher protections for a person's house than you do for the automobile that he's driving. That was a big difference. And also, this was something that was killed. Penalties were less. This was only a forfeiture. It was not a criminal action on the court. And if you'd let me give my third one, I'd give you one. But the biggest fundamental difference between Richards and Bowling, the rule in Richards, and also by extension the no-knock, the suspension of the no-knock and an ounce rule in felony drug warrants in both Richards and in Stevens, were essentially based on probability and speculation. Regardless of all the public policy concerns that in Richards, exigent circumstances, the rule by the Wisconsin court was adopted that exigent circumstances were presumed based on the likelihood that the drug dealers would be armed and therefore public safety and the police officers' lives would be at higher risk if the police knocked and announced their presence before going in. And Stevens said exigency was based on the destructibility of evidence. But in both of those cases, still, all those public policy arguments aside, those cases were based on probability and likelihood, whereas the thing that distinguishes drunk driving arrests and the standards in Bowling is this is a per se rule which arises in response to an immutable natural law. The thing that is different is that the alcohol level is always changing. It is never static. It is always in a state of flux. So that is why I believe that the Bowling case would survive the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Richards v. Wisconsin, and I'm out of time, and thank you very much. And I would like to, of course, invite you to Sheboygan County for your next trip.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wagner, and we'll take that invitation as well as this case under advisement. That concludes our hearing on 03-0952-CR, State v. Faust. We want to thank both lawyers for yet again arguing a Fourth Amendment case before us, and one that involved driving while intoxicated. The court is in recess until...